Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. 2012 is nearly over, and we here at WILL couldn't resist taking the opportunity to look back at the many significant news stories that impacted the two-state region this year. And so the Illinois Public Media News team gathered together, and with the tip of our caps to David Letterman, we compiled our own list of the top 10 news stories of 2012. On this special edition of Focus, we will reveal those top 10 stories. Also along the way, we'll discuss some honorable mentions, significant stories that occurred over the course of the year that just didn't quite make our list, and we'll talk a little bit about the news stories we're most looking forward to covering in 2013. Joining me on this journey back through the news of 2012 are the other members of the Illinois Public Media News team, Jim Meadows, Jeff Bossert, and Sean Powers. Gentlemen, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Before we get rolling on our list, a couple of things. First, we pre-recorded this conversation, so we won't be able to take any phone calls today, but we do encourage your comments at will.illinois.edu. And second, I want to briefly mention what these 10 stories have in common and why they made our list when other stories, even very significant ones, did not. What these 10 all have in common are these key factors. We covered them in some way on WILL in 2012. And even more important, all 10 of these news stories have the potential to have a significant and lasting impact on our region. Lots of people in Illinois and Indiana are directly affected by this list. Plus, I have to say, it's fun to come up with a list like this and leave off something really significant just to spark conversation, which, again, we hope you will engage in on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus, as well as on our Facebook and Twitter pages. And again, we'll give ourselves an out by talking about some major news events that didn't make the list this year. We'll do that near the end of the program. Okay, let's get started. And we'll start with number 10 on our list. And Sean Powers has that. 10. Sean.
Well, number 10 is the immigration debate shifts, and that includes two major issues, one being secure communities and the other being driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. So I've covered these two issues this year. The first report was about a federal program known as Secure Communities, where law enforcement agencies agree to hold non-citizens who are arrested in the local jail for up to a couple of days on behalf of federal immigration officials. The program is designed to take hardened criminals off the street, but critics say people who commit minor traffic offenses are separated from their families for potentially a few weeks while they're held at an immigration detention facility. I met an undocumented immigrant in the Bloomington Normal area, which follows a similar policy to secure communities. Her name is Angelina Lopez. She'd been detained after being arrested for several traffic violations.
My message for all those who have the same problem as I do, of not having a sheet of paper that makes all the difference, is to stay out of trouble. I congratulate those who have that paper because they don't make criminals out of them like they do of us.
Now, Lopez was separated from her family for 3 weeks while she was held in various detention facilities. Just to be clear, McLean County hasn't actually enrolled in secure communities, even though it enforces a very similar policy. Now, Illinois is one of a couple of states that hasn't activated secure communities statewide, but by the end of next year, federal officials expect the program to be implemented nationwide. And that's still unclear what that'll actually mean for Illinois. Now, the other major immigration issue I explored this year was an effort to allow undocumented immigrants in Illinois to obtain a driver's license. The driver's license issue is gaining traction and even getting some bipartisan support. The Illinois Senate this month approved legislation that would create a special category of driver's license for immigrants who can't prove legal immigration status. It's believed that by allowing undocumented immigrants in Illinois to obtain a driver's license, there will be more insured drivers on the road. The measure still has to get through the Illinois House, which it may do in the next year.
Gentlemen, it seems like immigration is one of those issues that we have talked about and has been examined by government at the federal level as well as at state and local levels. But it does seem like there were some real developments this year.
I believe there were. And the thing to remember is that these are cases which have a real grassroots existence. They're not just abstract issues when you're in Illinois, including downstate Illinois. They are things that affect the population here and affect employers here as well.
And I kind of wonder if this will be one of those stories that might make our top 10 list in 2013 as well.
For a couple of years, maybe.
Let's move on to number 9 and number 9 on our list, and that's Jim Meadows.
Well, number 9 that we decided on were advances towards gay rights and especially same-sex marriage. President Obama announced his support of same-sex marriage. Republican candidates and in a group opposed it, but it was President Obama who was reelected in November. Gay marriage referenda were approved in November in three states, and in a fourth state, a referendum against gay marriage failed. And this apparent increased acceptance of gay rights at the ballot box is having an impact in Illinois. Last month, State Representative Greg Harris, who sponsored Illinois' year-old civil unions law, announced a plan to sponsor new legislation to legalize same-sex marriage in the state.
I think each family needs to be equally respected. And I think as folks look around and they talk to their neighbors, they're seeing that there's no reason to treat, you know, one family in Illinois differently than another or show them less respect or, you know, equal treatment under the law. I think it's just a fair thing to do.
Harris has the support of Governor Pat Quinn on this issue, but there's no guarantee that all Democrats will go in that direction, and opponents of gay marriage are expected to mount a strong battle against the proposal next year.
If the ground is shifting for immigration, it's really moved, has it not, for gay rights?
That seems to be a national thing. Some social issues, this is not the case. Abortion is one where I think the battle lines are still drawn, but there's definitely been, I think, a change of view for many people, at least, across the nation and in Illinois.
Gay marriage, civil unions in Illinois, gays in the military. I mean, there's a lot happening here, certainly in 2012, and I imagine in the years to come as well.
And there is another wrinkle there, of course, that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to review a couple of gay marriage cases, and that and what impact that will eventually have on Illinois law, who knows?
Hey, maybe we can just repeat this show next year because we'll have the same subjects. Yeah, Sean.
Yeah, and something else to connect gay marriage with immigration. One aspect to the immigration issue is allowing same-sex binational couples to having one couple sponsor the other for a visa. And that's something that in the United States, because gay marriage is not recognized at the federal level, cannot happen. And so that'll be something else to look forward to potentially if it happens on either end of the spectrum.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're looking back at Illinois Public Media News' top 10 news stories of 2012 with the Illinois Public Media News team. We're joined by Jeff Bossert, Jim Meadows, and Sean Powers, and we're up to number 8 on our list of the top 10 news stories of 2012. And with that, once again, Sean Powers. Sean.
Number 8, Guns in America, Connecticut shooting and concealed carry ban struck down in Illinois. Now, the national conversation about gun laws has taken a noticeably different turn and tone following the deadly mass shooting this month at a Connecticut grade school. The shooting in Connecticut coincidentally happened a few days after a federal appeals court ruled that Illinois' ban on concealed carry was unconstitutional. Currently, Illinois is the only state to have a concealed carry ban. But at some point within the next few months, the Illinois General Assembly will have to come up with a law legalizing concealed carry. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn says the Illinois law should include reasonable restrictions, such as prohibiting people with a history of mental illness from having weapons. Quinn also renewed his call for a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. At the federal level, Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin says he supports reasonable limitations on the sale of firearms, ammunition magazines, and body armor. Speaking on the Senate floor just days after the Connecticut shooting, he offered this warning if nothing is done.
The number of victims of gun tragedies will continue to grow, and the silence of the funerals that follow will be matched by the silence of those in Congress who have the power to change it.
Now, Durbin also says he wants to renew the federal ban on assault weapons, but the Illinois State Rifle Association says mental health screenings, not gun laws, are needed to prevent more mass shootings. And the gun debate will continue into the next year. We are likely to expect new gun law measures pushed both at the federal and at the state levels.
Jeff, let me bring you in at this point. You know, it occurs to me that we've been hearing a lot about this idea that we've reached a tipping point in the debate over guns in America, but we're only hearing that maybe from the middle or the left side of the political spectrum. And then when we do hear from the National Rifle Association and some others, I don't hear any change in rhetoric or tone. I wonder if this is yet another story that maybe we'll see developments in 2013, but maybe not. Maybe it's the same debate we've always had.
That's quite possible. I mean, we spoke with the National Rifle Association. You did on Focus just a while back, and it didn't seem to have a real change in tone. They were very against the ban on assault weapons, And this would be, it'll be really interesting just to see how this conversation plays out.
Yeah. And Jim, an interesting and awful end to 2012, of course, with the shooting in Connecticut. But perhaps we'll see some change in the overall tone of the debate about guns.
Perhaps there's been a lot of volatility. There's both sides have strong feelings in the gun debate. Whether we'll just have to see whether people feel differently on how the debate is conducted.
Let's move on to number 7 on our list. And with that, here's Jeff Bossert. Jeff.
Well, earlier this year, Governor Pat Quinn, around February, hinted he wanted to make a number of cuts, but wasn't really specific. We soon found out that those cuts included a number of correctional facilities, including the women's prison in Dwight and the Supermax prison at Tams. It appears the governor has won that battle now, despite a legal effort from the prison workers' AFSCME union. Other issues include Illinois' growing pension debt and contract talks between the governor and the state's largest employee union, also AFSCME. Republican State Representative Chapin Rose, who will soon become a member of the Illinois Senate, says his priorities are the same in the coming weeks.
The issues are the same. I mean, it's the budget and jobs. You know, we've got to get some jobs in downstate Illinois, and nobody wants to create jobs until we have budget stability in the state and knows that we're not going to get smacked with massive tax increases, massive pension debt. So, you know, those two topics go hand in hand. You can't do one without the other.
Quinn also later vetoed a measure, we're talking about revenue for Illinois, intended to boost revenue. That's the expansion of gambling. But Quinn indicated recently that a compromise was close to allow additional casinos in places like Chicago and Danville. Democratic State Senator Mike Frericks of Champaign says he defends his 2011 vote to raise the state income tax from 3% to 5% for 4 years, noting that that was to pay down bonds to lenders. But Frericks says previous state legislatures didn't make their pension payments.
Something different has to happen. You either need to pump a lot more money into it or you need to reduce the benefits. And I think various unions that represent a lot of these public employees have come forward and say, we want to be part of the solution.
Now, Governor Quinn, in a recent visit to Champaign, said they were close to, an agreement on gaming, but said the pension problem will be solved first. The unfunded pension liability is close to $96 billion. In the final days of the fall veto session this month, rank-and-file lawmakers recently suggested a plan that would reduce the cost of living increases for retirees, but require workers to contribute more to their retirement. Legislators return to Springfield for the first week in January for the lame duck session.
Jim, let me bring you in on this one. When I first moved back to the region back in March, one of the first conversations that we had in the newsroom was, oh, well, we're going to see some movement soon here on pensions in Illinois. And now it's the end of December and really nothing's happened yet.
Well, there are ideas out there anyway. There have been a few ideas brought out, but nothing that anybody wants to make a final decision on. The governor's proposal, which is to have the local school districts shoulder more of the cost of their side of the pension expense, that expense now being shouldered by the state, is one approach, but it's certainly not a politically popular one. And the other ones, well, as where we're speaking right now, taping on December 18th, we'll have to see what lawmakers are ready to do in the lame duck session and if anything comes out of that at that point.
Jeff, it does seem as if the can has been kicked down the road about as far as it can, at least with the current legislature. That veto session starts up January 2nd, and they'll have a week to try and do something, or it's the next crop of lawmakers' problems.
Yeah, we mentioned that the pension proposal, even more recently, Governor Quinn really didn't have a suggestion. He had this PR campaign that many lawmakers knocked with Squeezy the Pension Python, the
right.
Cartoon snake, but he gave a history of pensions, but nothing really to suggest lawmakers take up.
Yeah, any reactions to Squeezy and the attempt to try and, you know, garner some greater attention from the general public on the pension debate?
I like Squeezy the Pension Python, but in some ways I think the governor is trying to harken back to his earlier days back in the days when newspapers repeatedly referred to him as a political gadfly, Patrick Quinn, the Patrick Quinn who led campaigns to set up the Citizens Utility Board and reduce the size of the Illinois House. This is a harder sell And I think a lot of people already know there are problems with pensions. Just getting the word out that there are problems with pensions is not necessarily going to lead to a solution.
Let's move on to number six on our list. Again, you're listening to a special edition of Focus as we look back at Illinois Public Media News' top 10 stories of 2012. I'm in studio with the Illinois Public Media News team, Jeff Bosser, Jim Meadows, and Sean Powers. And I guess I am responsible for number six here. Number six on our list is entitled Lugar v. Murdoch and the Soul of the GOP. So here's the thing. Last spring, longtime Indiana U.S. Senator Richard Lugar lost his primary election battle with Indiana Treasurer Richard Murdoch. Murdoch was, you'll recall, a Tea Party favorite, and his rhetoric sort of outflanked Lugar on the right, but it wasn't just that he represented himself as more conservative. The stark difference was that Lugar was characterized as someone who might from time to time reach across the aisle and compromise, whereas Murdoch stated that his idea of compromise was convincing the other side that he's correct. The question was whether the electorate as a whole was prepared to elect someone who would walk in sort of unwilling to compromise on most anything, including a subject that would ultimately be Murdoch's undoing, his stance on abortion and rape, which came out in a late October debate against Democrat Joe Donnelly. Here's what Murdoch had to say.
I struggled with it myself for a long time, but I came to realize life is that gift from God. And I think even when life begins in that horrible situation of rape, that it is something that God intended to happen.
And that, by most accounts, according to most political operatives, was kind of his undoing. Joe Donnelly wound up winning the Senate campaign. I want to get into how this is sort of endemic of the soul of the GOP part. But first, guys, I'm curious if anybody has any reaction to why we heard so many comments during this past election year about rape that got so many politicians into trouble. Jim?
I'm wondering if this is the new third rail of American politics, which is opposition to abortion in all cases, no matter what, that both Mr. Murdoch and Congressman Aiken in Missouri ran into this trouble by saying something in what turned out to be a very public platform that was easily exploited by their opponents.
It was. I think there were some folks who maybe understood philosophically this idea of wanting to take a hardline stance on abortion, but also wonder if there are certain exceptions that the public, even on either side of the debate, maybe have, for the most part, coalesced around, rape being one of those exceptions. And maybe there's a small percentage of the electorate that feels as Murdoch does, as Aiken did, but not enough to bring him to victory.
And that raises questions as to how conservative are the voters of Indiana in what's usually considered a conservative state, but they do elect Democrats to public office. And the question there is, was it simply revulsion at this particular remark and this particular attitude towards abortion in cases of rape? Or are voters not quite as conservative as Mr. Murdoch, although they might have been as conservative as Mr. Lugar?
And again, I'll bring Jeff and Sean in for this. This also speaks to a question of just sort of general personality and approach beyond the politics, the idea of sort of being unwilling to compromise on anything. The bigger story is that Donnelly's victory over Murdoch was one of several by Democrats over very conservative Republican candidates nationwide who found their way to success in the primary, but not in the general election. And those defeats and the changing demographics and voter turnout that brought out those defeats seem to catch the GOP off guard a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's just interesting. Jim mentioned Dick Lugar and his reputation for reaching across the political aisle and somewhat more moderate, perhaps, and the fact that that somebody won out in the primary over him, and perhaps maybe they went back to more of their political roots, so to speak, in Indiana in the general election.
And the question is, will voters be forgiving in 2014?
Indeed. It will be interesting to see where the GOP shifts now. They are doing some soul searching in the Republican Party about what that party stands for, and that is why Lugar v. Murdoch and the soul of the GOP made our list. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're looking back at Illinois Public Media News' top 10 stories of 2012 with the Illinois Public Media News team. Jeff Bossert, Jim Meadows, and Sean Powers are here. We will carry on with our list after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, joined by Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers, Jeff Bossert, and Jim Meadows. We are revealing Illinois Public Media News' top 10 stories of 2012. And we continue now with the top five. And with number five, here's Jim Meadows.
Number five was the drought that affected, well, just pretty much the entire continental U.S. at one point or another throughout the year, and may not be entirely over, although speaking now as we're taping December 18th, I know we're supposed to have rain in a couple of days, but an acre of Illinois corn yielded an average of 157 bushels last year. This year, by November, just 101 bushels. That's an average bushels per acre. So by that measure alone, Illinois is among the states more hard hit than others by the drought of 2012. Some Illinoisans may have measured the drought by their ability to use waters at their homes and business, such as residents of Decatur and other nearby towns relying on Lake Decatur as their reservoir, where the water levels have been very low this year. But the problem was worst for farmers. Will 2013 be any better? Speaking in November, John Hawkins of the Illinois Farm Bureau was cautiously optimistic.
I'm not sure if we're going to be totally out of the drought come spring, but compared to areas west of the Mississippi River, we're going to be much better off than we were this past summer.
Meanwhile, the problems suffered by farmers trickled down to the rest of us in the form of higher food prices.
Tell you what, as we were in the midst of the drought this year, we found ourselves constantly going to that drought monitor for the weekly reports telling us how severe a drought we're experiencing in the two-state region. And you would just see wide swaths of Illinois and Indiana in severe or extreme drought. And it was sort of almost a shock to the senses to see those reports come out each week.
And it was a challenge for media, just for us, maybe people, maybe not so much here because we have an agricultural staff, but I just wanted to point out that this is something that is new to even some people. What agricultural story are we going to do today in the wake of this drought, and what does this mean next year?
I relied on our agricultural programming director, Dave Dickey, for a background on this particular segment. And one thing he pointed out that hadn't been immediately that just didn't realize on a day-to-day basis is how something like a bad corn crop affects livestock. Of course,
they feed on corn.
They feed on corn. And what do farmers do if corn costs more? Well, if they can't get a better price for their animals, if those are locked in, they may just have to take the loss. Often what was happening is that they were selling their animals early. They were not fattening them up to what was considered full weight. They were essentially taking smaller animals to market. All that means less meat by volume available and higher prices as a result.
I want to bring another point to the conversation, the Farm Bill, the federal Farm Bill. Lawmakers still have to reauthorize it. We're waiting. During this whole process, all of us would contact our local members of Congress, soon John Shimkus, Tim Johnson, and ask them, where are you in the Farm Bill? Where are you in the Farm Bill? Where are you in the Farm Bill? And still there is gridlock over, do we cover this program? Do we cover that program? Food stamps, a very contentious issue. And this is a huge part of what farmers are going to rely on in terms of assistance in the wake of this really devastating drought.
It was an intense drought. And I guess one of the questions is what will be the long-lasting impact in 2013 as they go through the next round of crops? Is this something that will just be, well, that was a lost crop season? What do we have going forward?
I suppose that, rain could fall and everything will be back to normal, although farmers, producers will have to be catching up on losses they suffered last year. Dave Dickey does remind me of one thing. It may rain, but it's not just a matter of having rain. It's having rain at the right time.
That's right.
Yeah. In order to the crops to reach their full potential.
And for different crops. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, can we save corn? It's another one to say it's too late for soybeans, that kind of thing.
And this wasn't just a small dent. This was a catastrophe for many farmers, and it's going to be felt beyond beyond this month.
Let's move on to number four on our list, and this one hit pretty close to home to this location. Jeff Bossert, tell us about number four.
Number four is the resignation of former University of Illinois President Michael Hogan. Hogan stepped down early this year after repeated calls from faculty and students to step down. There were complaints about his management style, saying Hogan didn't communicate with faculty, and there were many letters signed by prominent faculty asking for him to step down. He was introduced in the summer of 2010. A few months before this, Lisa Troyer, the former chief of staff under Hogan, resigned after a series of anonymous emails surfaced intending to win over support of an unpopular enrollment management plan. Ultimately, the pressure was too much, and Hogan resigned in late March. U of I Board of Trustees Chair Chris Kennedy says Hogan's decision to step down accompanied a unanimous decision to appoint longtime administrator Robert Easter to a two-year term. In an interview in July, Easter says listening to faculty concerns was among his top priorities.
The faculty, in some sense, are the university. They embody the values of the institution. They embody the knowledge base. They are what make the university. They, because of what they do in their individual disciplines within their departments, have more insight than any of us in leadership have to what's the best strategy for moving forward.
President Easter says the role of administrators is to capture the insights of faculty and work within financial constraints to move their ideas forward. Prior to serving as president, he was the interim chancellor and provost most recently on the Urbana campus. Easter earns $450,000 annually, $200,000 less than Hogan did as president. And all indications we have after a few months of covering him in the news and trustees meetings is he's getting high marks from faculty and fellow administrators through the first 6 months in office.
Well, I had the chance to talk with President Easter on WILL-TV, actually simulcast here on AM 580, a special edition of Focus earlier this fall. He has a very calm demeanor about him, what question you ask him, very almost unflappable, just he sets you at ease with his approach.
And he is also someone who has been here for a long time under, several presidents of the U of I, whether they did well or not, came here from other institutions. President Easter has been an administrator for several years. He was getting ready to retire, I thought, wasn't he?
I think so. But as I recall, Sean, I think he signed on for a couple of years.
That's right. And they're very careful. They're not calling him interim president Robert Easter. They're calling him President Robert Easter because they want to establish that this is a permanent presence at the University of Illinois, some stability, which I think has been missing. At least that's what we're hearing from members of the university community.
Yeah, without passing any judgment on Michael Hogan and what he did as president, there was this sort of sense almost of an exhale from the faculty President Easter was announced as the next president of the university.
And maybe especially so because Mr. Hogan had been the second president to resign under pressure, his predecessor having gone under because of the admission scandal at the school.
And can I just say, you're looking at somebody like Robert Easter, who's been here for years and years and years, who's dedicated his hours, however many hours, countless hours to the university. He went through some personal tragic loss in his own family within the last year. And he's surrounded by all this controversy at the university. For him to take on this role, I think, really speaks a lot to his character.
Let's move on to number three on our list. And, Sean, you have that.
That's right. Number three, Tim Johnson's retirement, Rodney Davis's victory. So in April, six-term U.S. Congressman Tim Johnson, he's a Republican from Urbana, announced he was leaving Congress at the end of his current term. Johnson won his party's nomination for a seventh term in Congress, this time in the redrawn 13th Congressional District. His decision not to run came a little more than 2 weeks after he easily won the Republican primary. An emotional Johnson offered this explanation.
My time is limited. I've been serving office for 44 years. I'm also the father of 9 children. I have 11 grandchildren, and now 2. To compose myself, great-grandchildren. I've been a part-time father in all those years, and that's not good enough.
Shortly after Johnson announced his retirement, a list of candidates began putting their feet into the arena, hoping to replace Johnson as the Republican nominee in the November election. The contenders included a former Johnson aide, a staffer to Congressman John Shimkus of Collinsville, and a former Miss America winner. Party chairs in the new 13th district eventually chose Taylorville Republican Rodney Davis as the party's nominee. Davis prevailed in a hard-fought and expensive campaign against Bloomington Democrat David Gill, who previously ran against Tim Johnson three other times. Now state representative, or rather, now U.S. representative-elect Rodney Davis is only a few days away from joining the freshman class in Congress, and we're only about 22 months away from the next election in the 13th district.
Oh, you had to raise that. Jeff, I want to come back to Congressman Johnson for a minute. We certainly could hear in his announcement. That was an emotional moment for him. But it also raised some questions for not just those of us in the news media, but I think the electorate in general. The biggest question being not why was he retiring, but why now? Why after the primary?
Yeah, and he didn't have much of an answer, I remember, when he was asked that at that press conference. And this is not something that we were used to seeing out of Tim Johnson. We've seen a guy who's in his neighborhood or at Lincoln Square Village on his phone talking to constituents or walking with constituents. And this may forever be a mystery. He just said it was a family situation that led to his resignation. And it'll be interesting just to see how available he is. He is going to be teaching at Illinois State University in the next semester and probably still out and about in his community and someone we might be able to talk to.
Tim Johnson actually cited two family situations that he said needed to be attended to. He didn't say what they were. He has said more recently that one of them is well under control. He's actually from a political family, and his daughter Heather Stevenson, who will be stepping down this spring after serving as Inter-Urbana City Council Alderwoman, marks, I believe, the fifth generation of Johnsons and Evanses, to use his mother's side of the family, who have been in politics. So there's a lot of politics in the family, but there still needed to be more time for actual family business to attend it to. He has said, Tim Johnson has said more recently, that he's not going to be totally out of politics. He has a healthy campaign fund, and he says he plans to spend that money on political campaigns that he believes in.
You know, it's funny about this whole process of finding his replacement. He didn't endorse anybody in that race. He didn't endorse Republican Rodney Davis. He didn't endorse any of the Republican primary challengers. He didn't even endorse the independent candidate, John Hartman, Democrat David Gill, no one. And the reason he gave, at least for not endorsing Rodney Davis or David Gill, is he said the campaigns were way too negative. They needed to tone it down, and guess they didn't do it in time enough for him to make a decision.
It was a hard-fought campaign.
It was a hard-fought and a hard-spent campaign with the national parties and outside groups spending money here on both sides.
Jeff, I think we can't understate how impressive, though, a victory ultimately it was for Rodney Davis when you consider he was a little bit behind the eight ball and he didn't get the nomination until, or, you know, he wasn't named as the candidate until just a few months before the general election.
He had to be brought up to speed pretty quick and hit neighborhoods quite a bit. And we saw him a few times in Champaign-Urbana over the campaign season. And this was, it, I guess, speaks to the Republican support, especially, I guess, more of a downstate portion of the 13th district, that he was able to defeat David Gill for a fourth time. I mean, between the losses to him and Johnson.
If he had an advantage, it was he was a staffer for Congressman John Shimkus with the redrawn districts. Part of that district was old Shimkus territory. He may not have been the high-profile face, but he knew part of the area pretty well.
One thing we'll never know is whether he would have been the nominee had Johnson announced his plans to retire before the primary and it had been an open race for that GOP nomination. I guess that's something that's something for an alternate universe to worry about. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen here with the rest of the Illinois Public Media News team, Jim Meadows, Jeff Bossert, and Sean Powers, and we are revealing Illinois Public Media's news top 10 stories of 2012, and we are down to number 2 on that top 10 list. And with number 2, here's Jim Meadows.
Well, Craig, our number two story for 2012 was the presidential election, which, of course, was a big story, well, all over the country. With his political roots in Chicago, Illinois was key to this year's presidential election for Barack Obama. But Obama's strong support in the state, especially in Cook County, mean he didn't have to campaign here much. So we didn't see him much. We didn't see presidential candidates much at all. Certainly no other Democratic candidates, because the president was unopposed for renomination. Illinois did have some visits from Republican presidential hopefuls in the weeks leading up to the March primary. For Champaign-Urbana residents, the most notable visitor was Texas Congressman Ron Paul, who spoke to a mostly college-age audience at the University of Illinois.
The neoconservatives believe that we have to go overseas because we're an exceptional nation and we have to spread our goodness. Spread our goodness with a bunch of bombs and killing people? That doesn't work.
Ron Paul picked up an endorsement from Congressman Tim Johnson, but he placed a distant third in the Illinois GOP primary, far behind the eventual nominee Mitt Romney.
So the first thing that occurs to me about the 2012 presidential election, and it's one of two big things that were in my mind through the year, that was that this was the first presidential election after the Citizens United ruling. And there was a big question about how much impact money was going to have in this campaign. And by all accounts, money matters a great deal in politics. But one of the interesting results was the question of both the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign and their surrogates among super PACs spent gobs of money. And I'm not sure if we know yet if it really made a difference one way or the other for either one of them.
The question arises then is, does it make a difference, or now does it mean that this is the price of admission, that everybody has to throw all this money around just to stay in the game? That will partly be a matter of whether or not extremely wealthy people continue to believe that they should spend large amounts of their available funds to influence presidential elections. A lot of people who did spend a lot of money were not necessarily happy with the result if they actually thought that money could buy an election.
Go ahead, Sean.
Just at the state level, we even heard cases of major business owners threatening to leave Illinois depending on the outcomes of certain political decisions here in the here in the state. So there were obviously some major consequences that elections and political decisions had for many people here.
Well, and getting back to super PACs for a second, one of the interesting developments also was that a certain amount of, boy, I don't know if this is too strong a word, lunacy associated with this idea that there could be these large groups that technically are not coordinating with campaigns as they spend their money, but they really seem to be coordinating with campaigns as they spend that money. That was recognized and sort of taken to that height of lunacy by Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart as they created the Colbert Super PAC. And all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of dollars flowed in, and they were putting out ads basically making fun of the whole process. But also underscoring this idea that maybe there is still some work to be done on this campaign finance system we have.
You know, different groups may not coordinate in that they are talking to each other and synchronizing their watches, but it's easy to drop a lot of broad hints as to what, say, a campaign is doing, and other groups can pick it up. I know I saw that in the 13th district race, where one after the other in the space of a few days, the outside groups, the National Party, and Rodney Davis's campaign all picked up on the idea of mentioning in a certain way their opponent's past support for physician-assisted suicide. They didn't name what it was. They just mentioned that he lost a job because of it.
We also saw a continuing shift in demographics in this country having an impact on the presidential race. And in fact, that I know we alluded to this earlier in terms of how the GOP maybe needs to do some soul searching. There were some people on the right side of the political spectrum who were genuinely caught off guard, even on election night. Karl Rove, famously on Fox News, was caught off guard and convinced that his exit poll data was correct and what he was hearing from Fox News's own data was wrong. And there just seemed to be a surprise or a shock that turnout occurred the way it occurred, at least among some political operatives.
It depends on who you talk to. By the way, may I note that East Central Illinois is largely Romney territory, except for Champaign County, the county we're broadcasting from right now. This whole swath of the eastern side of the state, south of Will County, went for Romney. Karl Rove would be very comfortable here. But if you compare that to Cook County and other Chicago area counties and some western Illinois counties, it was not enough.
We have some more ground to cover here in just a few short minutes left. So before we reveal the number one story of the year, I wanted to give each of you an opportunity to talk about some stories that didn't make our list that interested you, that you thought were still significant stories, even if they didn't quite crack the top 10. I'll start with you, Jeff.
Well, one that I was able to pursue this year just out of fate is the fact that Roger Ebert turned 70 years old. And it was on the heels of some of the research I did in talking about a preview about this year's Ebert Fest that I found out about his birthday and realized how much of a local connection he still has. People like Steve Shoemaker, who's a featured host on a program here on this station, went to high school with Roger. And I found through him, I found other people that knew him from high school, other people that knew him from the U of I, and people that still live in town that grew up in. And they were childhood friends. So it was nice getting to know that Roger Ebert and learning a little bit about the life he had in Urbana and at the U of I.
Sean, what was on your list of also-rans?
Well, I added this because it's an issue that is very important to all of us in the news media, and that's the gradual decision to allow cameras in the courtroom. Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas Kilbright is the driving force behind the pilot program. He told us this year at the Illinois News Broadcasters Association's conference that he expects more courts to allow cameras in the future. So far, around, more than two dozen counties in Illinois allow cameras in courtrooms, including McLean, DuPage, Kankakee, and Knox counties. I'm anxious next year to see if other counties will be added to the list.
Jim?
I was looking at one story in Vermilion County where voters in November passed a referendum authorizing the Vermilion County Board to sell or lease the county nursing home, Vermilion Manor. There aren't many county-operated nursing homes in Illinois, but those that do exist, there's often a lot of support for them. At the same time, a lot of financial difficulty the way the healthcare system is now configured in keeping them going. And the Vermilion County Board had decided that, well, we just can't do this any longer. They're looking at not necessarily selling the nursing home. They're saying that perhaps its management are maybe privatized or something like that. They're looking at they're going to be exploring their options in the year ahead. But they were saying that if it weren't for the state's current tardiness in delivering funding for the nursing home on its end, they could probably get by.
I had a few stories. I couldn't whittle it down to one. They were stories that are maybe more national or international in scope, and so that's why they weren't on our list, but were major stories that I thought we should at least acknowledge. The first one, of course, was Superstorm Sandy, which was just a massive storm and had wreaked so much havoc, did so much damage in the northeastern United States, in New York and New Jersey, and they're still picking up the pieces there, and there's a lot of work to be done. That was, of course, a significant story in 2012 and one we continue to follow, at least the aftermath of it. Another one is the Euro crisis and Greece's economic woes and what impact that has on the world economy, because this really is, as has been described, a flat world, as Thomas Friedman likes to call it. It's all one economy in many ways these days.
You know, we do a lot of business programming from a lot of different sources here in WYLL, but one place where you could often hear mention of the problems with the euro and the European economy is on our agricultural programming and analysis of the commodities market. It's a global commodities market now, and what happens in Europe really has an impact on what sort of money farmers can get for their crops here.
One more big story that didn't quite make our list, but I think maybe because it has more to do with what will happen in 2013 than it does with what's happened in 2012, and that's the so-called fiscal cliff and all of the debate and machinations associated with that. We're all still in sort of a wait-and-see pattern to determine what will happen in terms of tax rates going up, spending going down, and so forth. So those were the stories that occurred to me as ones that were worth noting. Shall we move on to number one? You guys ready for it? And I think it's me. It's my job to do it. Okay, the number one, Illinois, I feel like I need a drum roll. Anybody? There you go. Okay, all right, that's enough. The number one Illinois public media news story of the year is the Supreme Court health care ruling. On June 28th, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act's health insurance mandate, as well as other elements of the healthcare overhaul. This is our top story of the year because of the impact it will have on residents of Illinois and Indiana. Just as an example, here in Illinois, there are about 1,914,000 residents who are not insured. That's 15% of the state. The 5-4 vote indicating the health insurance requirement for most Americans in the Affordable Care Act was not, in fact, a mandate, but a tax, and that the Congress has the authority to tax those who don't buy health insurance. That ultimately means many more people will be insured in the years to come. And if the Affordable Care Act works as intended, should lead to more and better preventive care for more people. That may mean the costs of emergency room care may eventually go down. It means drug discounts for seniors will continue. Medicaid coverage for more low-income Americans. Insurers will be barred from turning down patients with pre-existing conditions. Young adults can remain on their parents' health insurance until their 26th birthday. All of this could potentially have been struck down this summer. And the fact that the Supreme Court upheld pretty much all aspects of the Affordable Care Act, that's a significant event. The day of the ruling, we spoke with Claudia Lenhoff, Executive Director of Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, and she said the court's decision to uphold the healthcare law will have a huge impact on area residents.
East Central Illinois actually has a fairly high rate of uninsured individuals, and Champaign County has a very high rate of people living in extreme poverty. So the expansion of health coverage is going to benefit thousands of local residents.
So there is a big political impact here, and it affected number two on our list, the presidential election, maybe in terms of the fact that since the Affordable Care Act was upheld, it did not become the centerpiece issue in the campaign.
But it was an issue, and one place, we're talking of political races, of course, was in the 13th district races, where both candidates, Rodney Davis and David Gill, actually wanted to change the healthcare system. Rodney Davis wanted to take it back to more like it was, and of course David Gill wanted to go even further with what he termed Medicare for All. A lot of Republicans ran against healthcare, but they ran against it, I think, with the idea that Mitt Romney would also be elected president, which would give them a lot more leverage to do something about it with Barack Obama in for a second term in the White House, even though John Shimkus and Rodney Davis are going to Washington from our listening area. They'll have a lot of things they'll try to do, but there's less than they can do than if they had a Republican in the White House.
Jeff, I think we were all unanimous in making this our top choice. How come?
Well, because all we had to do was think about how. I look back at the day we thought this was going to come down to the Supreme Court a couple of days before it actually did, and all the different players that would have something to say about this, and not only political arenas, but people like Claudia Lenhoff and healthcare providers. I mean, the impact that this would have, and what will happen in Illinois or in Indiana, and setting up the healthcare exchanges. There's just a whole litany of things that we have yet to see what the impact this ruling is going to have.
That takes us right into what we're looking forward to in 2013, and we have just a minute or two in which to do it. So let me start with Jim Meadows. What are you most looking forward to covering in 2013?
Well, one of the things I'm most looking forward to covering is the problems of another county nursing home, and that's the Champaign County Nursing Home. When I was covering the county board races this year, everybody talked about one of the issues being what they were going to do about the nursing home in 2013. They didn't know exactly how things would end up, but They were watching very carefully the financial picture, and everybody was pretty sure that there was going to be trouble and they were going to have to deal with it.
Sean Powers.
The upcoming gubernatorial race in 2014, we're already hearing about some candidates who might be throwing themselves in the ring, possibly Republican Congressman Aaron Schock of Peoria, Republican State's Treasurer Dan Rutherford, Republican State Senator Kirk Dillard, Democrat Bill Daley, who served as President Obama's chief of staff, and possibly Democratic incumbent Governor Pat Quinn. So this will be another race to follow.
Jeff Bossert.
The impact of some of the things that are supposed to be happening in the legislature. Are we going to pass a gaming bill in the next session of the legislature? And will be we in a few months close to setting up a Danville casino once it's built, and the closure of the prisons and specifically TAMS and closer to this area, Dwight? What will that mean for those communities?
As for me, I am looking forward in 2013 to the end of the NHL lockout. Right?
Yeah, sure.
Agreed?
Of course.
There are two fine minor league teams in this area.
All right.
And we're going to try to watch one of those games.
We will attend one, yes.
Possibly. Yeah, we'll see.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. That's it. Illinois Public Media News top 10 stories of 2012 have been revealed. What else did we miss that was significant for Illinois and Indiana in 2012? What stories are you looking forward to hearing us cover in 2013? Let us know. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Post your comments at will.illinois.edu/focus. Or visit our Facebook or Twitter pages to share your thoughts there. Jim Meadows, Jeff Bossert, Sean Powers, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Travis Stansel. Jason Croft was our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.